Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I am Ben. We are joined, as always, by our super producer, Noel the Piano Man Brown.
Noel tickling the ivories Brown.
Yeah. Noel 88 Fingers Brown.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah. And fun fact, actually, in his life outside of working with us here at How Stuff Works, our friend Noel is a multi-instrumentalist.
Yes, he is.
Talented musician.
He tours, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has been on a couple tours. That might be his story to tell. I don't want to disclose his personal business there.
That's right. But he plays local gigs and things still.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Always welcome to hear, what he's up to because, man, he's got so much happening here at work and outside. He's even got some cool new toys here that are kind of music related for other shows.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get him to make some beats for me.
Yeah. I forget what it's called. It's like a cloud push or something. I will totally butcher the name of the product, but it's a really cool toy to use.
And today, speaking of astonishing segues, Scott. Buddy, this podcast has been a long time coming.
It really has. So long that I have lost the initial email where this came from. And I know we've mentioned it in, Nuts and Bolts recently?
Yeah.
Maybe even twice. But this is one that we definitely wanted to get to and has been near the top of the list for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's about piano makers that also built automobiles.
Hold on. You might be saying, what? Pianos? They're not remotely like cars. Ah, however, the answer may surprise you because what we found after, this was years ago when we first received this email, what we found and what you told me about initially was that there's a strange correlation.
Yeah, that's right. And, it's not always as simple as it seems. Like, it's not that, they just open up a factory and start building cars. It's never like that. There's always this, sometimes there's a slow integration or they make a part that somehow leads to something or it's just maybe a family member that is involved in this. So there's a few different examples here we're going to give. And I think I've got, personally, here in front of me, I've got about seven examples of, piano makers that also built cars or parts of cars or whatever. Mm-hmm. But some of this history is really going to surprise you, I think. And it did me, and when the listener wrote in and said, specifically about one of the vehicles we'll get to. It's not the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhere in the middle. I'll note it when we get to it, but what an incredible vehicle this guy built. And that was kind of the standout of this whole thing. All right, Ben, so maybe we should just jump right into a couple of examples here, because we've got, like I said, seven or so in front of me. Where do you want to start? You want to start with maybe Mercedes and Steinway?
Oh, yes. Actually, that's one of my favorites. So let's start with that. We're talking about a fascinating partnership between two people, a fellow named William Steinway of Steinway & Sons fame, and a fellow named Gottlieb Daimler. Now, let's do a little context here, just real quick. So the Steinway family comes over to the U.S. in 1850, and they make a name for themselves rapidly with the quality of Steinway pianos.
Yeah, so like when we say it's the Cadillac of the automotive world.
Oh, that's good.
This is the Steinway of the piano world, right?
Right.
And everybody uses Steinway as a, when you say it's a Steinway or like a Steinway, that is a mark of quality.
Even if you don't play piano, you're aware of the Steinway name.
Sure.
So at the same time, if we go forward a little bit, over in Europe in 1886, Daimler-Benz creates the first car of theirs that they've built. Right?
Well, sure, the Patent Wagon, right?
The Patent Wagon.
Yeah, and they're two vehicles, actually, that are developed independently of each other.
Right, yes.
Which becomes the Patent Wagon, which then is, of course, known as the first car, really. So what is that, 1886, you said? In 1888, Steinway gets together with Daimler, right? Is it Gottlieb Daimler? I think it's Gottlieb Daimler.
Yeah.
And they discuss the idea of engines, because engines are sort of a new thing at the time, internal combustion engines that are small enough to put into these new automobiles, which are brand new.
These newfangled horseless carriages.
Yeah, but they're not talking about cars yet even. That's still a decade away.
Yeah, what they're talking about now are different applications for engines.
Exactly. So they're talking about putting them in boats, and they're talking about stationary engines. And Steinway is saying, hey, you know what? I can try my hand at this because there's probably a huge market for this.
Mm-hmm. And they started kicking this idea around when Steinway was traveling to Germany, and
around 1888.
Yes, great point, Scott. And so this is literally like 2 years after these kind of vehicles become a thing, a maybe thing, not even a definite mm-hmm. thing. And so imagine, if you will, ladies and gentlemen, these two giants of industry who are bonding on their equally tremendous success in their respective fields, and Steinway, you know, having the engineer or the carpentry and engineering capability to build a coach, and Daimler having the mechanical engineering ability to create these engines, start talking a little more and more seriously about the idea of doing something wild, something no one had done before. Because let's keep in mind, right now, at this point in time, all of the few places manufacturing what we would recognize as automobiles are located where?
In Europe.
In Europe.
Yep, in Europe. So they're talking about this, and they're saying, well, you know, there's a chance here that we could bring this over to the United States. In fact, so they have this facility in Hartford where they can create the engines. They can build the engines.
Right. Steinway makes a contract with an outfit called the National Machine Company there in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah. And then he's also got a piano factory in Long Island, which has enough space that if they do want to use these engines in a boat application, mm-hmm. they've got plenty of factory space, I guess, to install engines in these boats.
Right. The floor has enough room for these for them to put these together. So what is let's see, where do you want to go next?
Well,
here?
Okay, here's the thing. It, not long after all this happens, and there's a few other steps along the way. Steinway Steinway actually was the one who chose the name Daimler Motor Company, apparently. So he's the one who coined the term when they were going to become incorporated. And I guess we can probably, you know, there's a few things here and there that we should talk about, but let's just say that in 1888, when they were first talking,
uh-huh.
they weren't thinking about automobiles right away. So
right.
what happened was in 1896, this is when, or you know what, let me back it up even one more step, because it was around, here's his idea, and this is in 1895. There's a newspaper interview with William Steinway, and he does have a plan for cars at that time. So it's, again, this is like seven or 8 years later that he's talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, we intend to produce cars for the American market that are capable of carrying between 2 and 4 people and will be driven by engines between 2.5 and 3.5 horsepower. Each car will have 4 different speed settings, 3.5, 6, 9, and 14 miles per hour. So a 4-speed car with very specific ranges mm-hmm. of speed. He says the fuel petroleum costs about 1 cent per horsepower an hour, making the automobile considerably less expensive than actual horsepower. He considered Daimler's wire wheel car too lightly built for the rough cobblestone streets we have in this country, meaning the United States.
Right.
And he says with that intent that Daimler Motor Company would create a model that would be adapted for conditions in America. So this is in 1895 he's saying this. Again, 7 years after they started the whole boat motor, static motor
right.
thing. And this is kind of, this is the sad thing. Steinway died in November of 1896. So 1 year later, he passes away, the founder of Steinway Pianos.
Right.
His heirs almost immediately sold their shares in Daimler Motor Company to General Electric Company. So mm-hmm. that's the GE that we know today.
Mm-hmm.
Sold the shares to them. And from 1898 onwards, they manufactured, where their manufacturing operations became known as the Daimler Manufacturing Company. And the first American Mercedes car was produced in 1905. So it was a long time after that. So
right, because Daimler also passed away in 1900, so neither of them lived.
Okay, so neither one of them saw this come to fruition, because in 1905, that was the very first American Mercedes car. Now, the American Mercedes was a huge vehicle. It was a big, the Mercedes chassis at the time. They had Daimler Motors, but it was a chassis that Steinway then bodied. The unfortunate thing here is that they didn't produce a whole lot of them because there was very short or limited time, I guess. It was, I think, between 1905 and 1907, I believe. And only I'm going to have to really dig into this even farther because I've only been able to find one example so far, and it's owned by a place in Irvine, California. Mm-hmm. And the one that I've seen is it's a place called it's a Mercedes-Benz dealership. It's called the Classic Center in Irvine, California, and they have one. They have an American Mercedes there, but I've never seen another one in since. But along the way, they've all just kind of gone away. And if there is one out there, I'd love to know about it, of course. You know, if anybody's seen one in a museum or anything, but these American Mercedes models are very, very rare. And if you want to see one, you can take a look at the photos from, you know, that where you can visit the Mercedes-Benz Classic Center, I suppose. They have a lot of classic vehicles on display there. But, you know, the thing is, like, one that I saw was somebody had just taken a photo, and they didn't really realize what they were looking at until later they heard the story about the American Mercedes.
Do you want to know an interesting little tidbit of history?
Sure.
Here?
Yeah.
Steinway and Daimler were introduced by someone who's also very important to the story of the automobile at large.
Who's that?
Willem Maybach.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. He was the one. He was the one who introduced them. That's the German engine designer and industrialist.
Yeah. Let's move on to another one, Ben. That is also pretty straightforward, I suppose. This is another piano maker that actually built cars. Now, this one's the story is a little bit twisted on this one, so I'll try to get as much of the detail out there as I can. But it's the Heine Velux.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, Heine Velux. Now, this is an interesting one because this is, again, it's the one the listener wrote in about specifically about this vehicle. It's a pretty fascinating story, and there's a lot to it.
And it's a deep cut as well.
Yeah, this is a guy, his name is Gustav Otto Heine out of San Francisco, California, and he was the owner of a very successful piano company called the Heine Piano Company.
No, he moved from Germany to San Francisco.
Oh, okay, got it.
So
he was pretty new here to San Francisco around, what, 1903?
Yeah, yeah. I just want to say there's one detail. I'm sorry to interrupt. But there's one detail about this I think is interesting and so indicative.
What's that?
Of self-made men. Well, he went to work originally for a place called the Brun Piano Company as a piano tuner, but he hated the guy who owned it.
Oh, okay.
He did not like his boss. And then he actually got in a physical altercation, a fight with the owner, and they were using tuning hammers.
A tuning hammer fight?
True story, yeah.
No kidding.
He had a scar from it.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
It was a severe fight, like a serious one. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So he ended up becoming the owner of this company, and then he changed the name to...
The Heine Piano Company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. All right. I see. So it's actually he took over that mm-hmm. Company
after right. after a duel.
So this is turn of the century, right?
Yeah.
We're just into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1903, he must have had an interest in automobiles at the same time as well,
mm-hmm.
Because he became the first Ford dealer on the West Coast in 1903. If you know anything about the time here, we're building up to one cataclysmic event that is not good.
Yeah.
So by 1905, you know, 2 years later after he has this Ford dealership, he had formed something called the Heine Motor Company. And the Heine Motor Company began building his own cars.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually built three touring cars mm-hmm. before, and this is what happened, before 1906, that's the great San Francisco earthquake. Just horrific event that it crumbled the city, really.
Right.
Lots of death and destruction. But following the earthquake, he offered he had three of these cars that he had already built under the Heine Motor Company. He offered the federal troops use of his three vehicles for transporting supplies, transporting the wounded, the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of gave those up for service at that point. And of course, his piano business was destroyed in the earthquake as well.
Right.
You remember there was a lot of fires and all kinds of things happening.
So about 80% of the city was destroyed.
Yeah, incredible destruction in this thing in 1906. So it takes him a long time to come back from this, but he gets his piano business back up and running because that's his main source of income
uh-huh.
and I think his initial main love. And by 1921, he's kind of back into things again and wants to reestablish himself in the automotive world. So he buys a company called the Economy Steel Manufacturing Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a brand new car designed and then built with resources from that company. And this is the 1921 Heine Velux. And Hyna, that of course, Hyna is his name.
Yeah.
Velox is a Latin word, which I believe means swift. So, makes sense that he would call it that. It's a strange name when you read it, but that's what that means. It was advertised as a custom-built luxury car and was first shown at the San Francisco Auto Show. I would guess that'd be the 1921 show. And it had hydraulic brakes on all the wheels. It had a V12 engine.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, the V12 engine that was commissioned from a company called Wheatley, which was out of Indianapolis, I believe. So he had this thing. That's got to be expensive right there. I mean, to have an engine designed and built, especially a V12. This is a huge, huge vehicle. It's a massive car with a 148-inch wheelbase. And that's so get this, Ben. That's almost 12 and a half feet between the wheels. That's like, wheel center to wheel center. And then overhang. I can't imagine how big that thing must have been. So it's a huge, huge car. And the thing is, it's also very, very expensive.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's scandalous. Okay. So what at the top end, because there's variance, right? It was like $17,000 to $25,000.
Yeah, in 1921.
And did you already pull it up?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, do you know what it is? Go ahead.
I've got it as almost $331,000.
Yeah, that's a good ballpark. That's about what I have, too. So a very, very expensive car in its time. In fact, so expensive that, it just didn't sell. I think he made a few of them, right?
Yeah, he made several of them. But before we get to just real quick for that part,
sure.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I've got to say, Scott, can we do a comparison price of some other cars at the time?
Oh, sure. One thing? Can I interrupt your thought?
Yeah.
We didn't talk about the price of the American Mercedes. That was ridiculously expensive
well. Yeah.
No, but it wasn't it like, I think they said that it was more expensive. Okay, so imagine a Steinway piano, which today I think sells for $120,000, right?
Cheapers.
They say that, it was proportional back then, when they were making this car. So in 1906, it cost seven times the amount of the top piano that Steinway made during that time. So it was very, very expensive during it in its day. I can't remember the exact number. I think it was, ballpark, I'm going to say it was like $7,000 or something like that in 1906.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah. So, I didn't mean to interrupt your thought with
I felt
we had to get it while we're still close.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so let's do some price comparison.
Let's.
All right.
All right. So, we said that was about $25,000 on the top end in 1921 dollars.
Yes.
Which makes it about $330,880-something thousand in today dollars.
Mm-hmm.
The Rolls-Royce, for comparison at the time, sold for less than 10 grand in 1921 dollars.
Whoa.
And that was still huge. American's highest price model was $5,250. The Big Six limos were $6,500. It's just.
So this Hyna Velox was 2.5 times as expensive as the Rolls-Royce of the day.
Western Gales Model A.
Five times more expensive than the most expensive U.S.-built model of the day?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so that's a super expensive car. Now, I think he made, five or six of these things, maybe?
Right.
I think it was only five, maybe. And they had some other things going for them. They had some interesting features.
They had one unfinished limo.
Okay.
But, yeah, as far as actually built, yeah.
Yeah, and where they went, I mean, this is kind of unusual. So, Here's what happened to at least one of them. I find this a little bit funny though, and sad. He wanted to demonstrate his car to Chevrolet, and he demanded to see the head engineer of Chevrolet. So someone points and he says, "Oh, the head engineer is over there because he's at the facility or whatever." So as he heads over to talk to the guy, someone steals the car from behind him as he's walking away. Can you believe that? This is 1921, 1923, somewhere around there?
And that car theft remains unsolved.
Yeah, it's unsolved, but then get this. The following year, Chevy releases a car with pivoting windows, which was a design element of that vehicle that he was trying to show to the design engineer at Chevrolet.
Which makes you think, doesn't it,
Scott? It really does. Not saying
he did it.
It's just a very weird twist in this whole thing. And now we can't say, that they stole the car or anything like that, but it's pretty apparent what happened there, I think. By 1923, I think the company eventually dissolves, right? Because, they're just not selling, of course. He went throughout the rest of his life building pianos, happily doing that. But the five cars that he had, you know, there were, I think, what, three? There were three that were left at this point because one had been stolen.
Right.
Something else happened. I don't know if it was the unfinished limo that you were talking about or not. But he had three that were kind of finished, and he took them to a local dealership and allowed them to use them for display, and they disappeared from there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this car has, like, it's just a strange history with what was left, really. The Victoria, I believe, ended up in the Harris Collection in out in Nevada, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah,
And I think, you know, that whole thing, it was a private, which is now in a private collection somewhere on the East Coast, I believe. So, God, I don't know. Where would we go after that? Because it's like a big mystery what happened with most of the cars. We know where one is. That's it.
Yeah. You know what it makes me think of, though? I always hope that these sorts of mysteries will be solved, because we have found that decades after the fact, in some cases, almost 100 years after the fact, secret car collections are still being discovered.
Yeah, I like that, but I also like the element of there's still a mystery out there. I kind of enjoy that. You know?
I mean, the odds against us finding something like that are pretty high at this point. It's rare for those sorts of things to be discovered. What I like about it is it makes me think of, you know, all these what ifs, all these alternate universes. Because what if the San Francisco earthquake had not occurred in 1906? What if it occurred in the mid 20s or something like that? If that happened, it's interesting to wonder how much further the Velux could have gone.
Yeah, that's true. You know? I mean, yeah, he would have had another 15 years to practice his trade. Would he have picked up with, you know, let's say that both businesses were still destroyed in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Would he have picked up with the pianos again, or would he have decided that maybe the automobile was his way to go?
He doesn't strike me as the kind of person who wanted to design an automobile for the people. He was clearly aiming for the top of the market. And then when that market crashes, right, leading into the Depression era, it still would have been tough. This is both a case of unfortunate timing and a case of, you know, you take a gamble when you position yourself in a specific spot of any market.
That's true. Yeah, he was going for the very top echelon.
The top of the top.
Really, yeah. Really top end.
And you know, as history bears out, most of what people were buying at the time were $500 cars.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
Model A's and stuff.
Exactly right. Or even a used vehicle for $100, you know?
Right.
I mean, and here's this guy with a $25,000 automobile that's 2.5 times the price of a new Rolls Royce. I mean, it's amazing. So again, bad timing, but hey, tell you what, I've got a few more here. You want to just kind of quickly go through them shorter notes, I guess,
than
we had for the others. History. You know, of these cars gets terribly complex if you really start to dive into the specs of the vehicles and all that. So let's just let's keep a little bit more on the surface on these.
You got it. I won't go too far in.
All right. So all right. Here's the thing. There's another company called Foster and Company out of Rochester, New York, and they were an established piano company, building company, trying to build automobiles around the turn of the century again, around 1899. That is when the founder of that company, George G. Foster, built an experimental steam car. Because remember, steam cars were a thing at that time. And he organized this Foster Automobile Company right around the turn of the century, right around 1900. I think it was in 1902 when they were producing something like 5 steam cars every week. And they had 50 employees that were doing this, you know, full-time job. And again, this is a guy that accustomed to building pianos. And then later, they started to build an electric car. So in 1903, things aren't going so well because the company had to be sold not long after its founding to another guy. Like, I'm sure that it was a matter of, you know, getting investors and building up capital, that type of thing.
Sure.
So most of the investors left after he sold the company, except for George Foster. He stayed with the company. And this other guy, his name is Mr. Park Densmore. Mr. Park Densmore, turns out he was embezzling funds from the company.
Right.
And this came about, you know, of course the company's going bankrupt, but all the news really broke right around then, you know, that he's stealing funds.
He skipped town.
Yeah, he leaves with what amounts to $30,000, which is quite a bit of money back then.
Oh, I heard it was 40 grand.
Oh, okay, so $40,000. That's a significant chunk of change back then.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't be found anywhere. He's able to get away because it's 1903. You can do that.
He probably stole that Velox.
Yeah. Maybe he did. And here's the thing. He wasn't the only one embezzling money from the company. I think there's also rumors that there were ugly rumors that George Foster was also embezzling money from the company.
Ooh.
So he also disappeared after 1903, never to return again. So he lost not only his piano business and also, you know, the automobile company.
Right.
Because he couldn't turn it, you know, he couldn't have his face shown in public again after this. So these guys ended up being kind of like dirty crooks, but they made pianos and cars at the same time. That's why they're in this podcast.
That's true. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. The next one. This one is a little bit more loose in the connection. The Jesse French Piano Company of Newcastle, Indiana. And
okay, now this is a new one to me. I found the other ones.
All right. So the French company was a big player in the piano world back in the turn of the century again, 19th century, 19th and 20th century. So they started out in Nashville in Tennessee in 1875, and by
Nashville. Sorry, I'm legally required to do
shout
that.
Out to your friends in Nashville,
uh-huh.
Your homies in Nashville, right?
My hometown people.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
That's true. And by 1898, this company was called the Kell French Piano Company because I think there was some ownership changes around then.
Uh-huh.
By 1903, there was a devastating fire at the factory in Tennessee, and they decided to move the whole thing to Newcastle, Indiana, with the help of civic leaders in that area that pledged to buy the required amount of stock to build this new factory. In, I guess it would be right around the Indianapolis area. And here's the thing. The connection is really that, you know, the person who started this Jesse French Piano Company had three sons. And one of those three sons went into the early days of the automobile building industry. So he's like a pioneer of the industry, right? And he formed what was to later be known as the St. Louis Motor Carriage Company in I think it was 1899 when this happened, so just before the factory was moved, with a guy named George P. Doris, who would later build the Doris Automobile Company from 1906 to 1925. So, again, it's the early days, and it's like the founders, and, you know, they're changing companies, and they're building different vehicles.
Yeah.
But so the son is the one who is the connection here to the piano builder.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Again, that's a kind of a weak – this is probably the weakest link one that we have here of this whole thing. But again, the St. Louis, what did I call it there?
St.
Louis Motor Carriage Company. That's a long name. is kind of they had a lot of firsts. I mean, John French was the guy to drive a new St. Louis, on the first ever automobile trip between St. Louis and Chicago. So, you know, this is how early this is. Like, people hadn't ever done that before. And he was the first one to do that. But of course, you know, that John French name carries a lot of weight in the piano world as well at the time.
I imagine, yeah.
So, you know, it's just interesting how this whole thing happens. I guess he also was a race car driver. He drove in a 1901 New York City to Buffalo race, but I think there were some financial problems with the company.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to Peoria, Illinois in 1907, and then I think finally the company went into receivership at some point not long after that.
Isn't that a shame?
Yeah, yep. But the next one on our list, Ben, is it's a piano company out of Detroit, Michigan, which makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Grinnell Brothers Piano Company. And if you are from that area,
yeah.
I think there's a Grinnell Street. There's
right.
There are buildings that you can still see downtown that are, you know, Grinnell Brothers.
Wasn't there also like a music store at some point too?
Yeah, they had a music store. And I think they had a big operation out in Holly, Michigan, which is a suburb not far from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
You know, 40, 50 miles, something like that.
So,
Holly in Oakland County, I think.
They started, they built their first pianos in 1902.
Yeah. Yep. Early on. No, I'm sorry.
They started before in 1882, making organs.
Yeah, that's right. And they built their first piano in 1902.
By which, of course, you and I mean church organs, not like kidneys.
Yes. Well, of course, of course. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, then they stretched out to the Oakland County, you know, the Holly, Michigan factory, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They got these big factories all over town, right? So it
right.
makes sense that they've got a lot of room. And I think this company kind of hung around for a long time. They were around till like 1967. Oh, I'm sorry, 1981, until they finally had to close their doors. But the tie-in here is that they produced an electric car around 1912, from about 1912 to 1915. They were one of the, again, as so many of these are, one of those defunct automobile companies that we learned about years ago on this show.
Right.
There were thousands of them. Remember here in the United States, this is one that lasted just 3 years, the Grinnell Electric Car Company. And so the Grinnell was produced through 1915, and then the business just simply had to close in about 1916 because even in that era, electric cars were still kind of growing, up until about 1915, and they were just, again, bad timing. You know, they were on the tail end of it.
Well, also they had a product that was more expensive than competitors.
That's true. Yeah.
So theirs was $28,000 around there. It had some pretty cool stuff.
Wait. $28,000 in
no,
that,
I'm
in
sorry,
that year?
$2,800.
Oh, okay, that makes
great
more
correction.
Sense.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's okay because I think we just heard the $25,000.
Yeah.
I was like, what? No way.
Thank you. Good save. Yeah, $2,800. But they claimed a 90-mile range per charge, which
that's,
is impressive for the time.
That's really, really good. And what does the Nissan Leaf get? 50?
Hey,
that's a different set of circumstances. I get it.
I think in part because of the price point, in part because of the market at the time, what ended up happening is, as you said, Scott, they got out of the auto business around 1915, and they didn't go bust. They just decided to focus on what was working, which at the time, those were pianos.
Yeah, simply went back to making pianos. And like I said, they kind of hung around Detroit for a long, long time. I think this is the Detroit riots of 1967. Just really, really hurt the business, of course, because that was right where they were located. And by 1981, they just had to shut down. So that was the end of the Grinnell Brothers Piano Company. The next one on our list was the Stant Manufacturing Company out of Connersville, Indiana. Now, that's an interesting one. You may have seen the word Stant, on your own vehicle if you open the hood and you look at the radiator cap. A lot of aftermarket caps and some from the factory, I believe, are from Stant. So they do all kinds of things. They offer, right now, they offer fuel caps. They offer thermostats. They have radiator caps. There's all kinds of stuff that they do. They have a racing operation as well, for Stant.
Because they're largely parts manufacturers.
Yeah. So you might think, well, what's the tie-in here? Well, they started making piano tuning pins. So making these piano tuning pins early on, and we're talking like early on, in 1899, they're making those.
Mm-hmm.
And they grew to be the largest piano tuning pin manufacturer in the United States. And what's weird is that I think it was World War I, they started making submarine engine parts for the Navy. So they needed a completely different set of
skills.
Yeah, exactly. A different skill set to make these marine parts, these engine parts for submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, they said, well, we're doing this already. We can make automobile parts. That's
sure.
Something that's going to be big after the war here. We're talking after World War I. Automobiles are going to catch on, we think. So, well, they knew they were at that point, right?
Right.
But they continued to make a lot of little things on the automobile, like aftermarket type parts, caps and things like that. That we said, Henry Ford himself came to Stant to say, well, we'd like you to design the radiator cap on the Ford Model A in 1928, and that's what they did. They designed that 1928 cap because remember, I think that one that's actually the cap for the radiator, the hood ornament.
Mm-hmm.
So they designed hood ornaments for not only them, but also for Lincoln, Pierce Arrow, Packard, Cadillac, and several other automobiles of the day that had a similar design where the cap was the hood ornament. I'm having a hard time saying that.
They're kings of the caps.
Yeah. And, that kind of carried on, and they're enormous today. I mean, big company even now. You can go online and find Stant fuel caps and thermostats, like I said. They have fuel caps, I think, for something like 99% of the vehicles that are on the road today in the U.S., so...
Wow.
Very versatile. They have a huge catalog of, potential, products. I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah. They have this wide variation. It's interesting because that's not the only time it's happened that there was a company that focused just on those parts rather than going the whole hog and making an automobile entire.
Sure. Yeah, that happened a lot. And I think that in the case of piano makers, and I, you know, these are just a few examples that we have here. There's another one that's Yamaha. I don't know if we, should we even talk about Yamaha, maybe?
Sure, yeah.
But to get to your point, though, like a lot of them would make, you know, they had the ability to make these really intricate wood designs, you know, like pieces that fit together just perfectly because they did it for their cases, for their grand pianos or their baby grand pianos or whatever. But they also had to have the ability to make that work with other metal components. And sometimes they would have their own in-house foundry or they'd have their own in-house blacksmith that would make those parts. And it just seems like it's a natural marriage between coach builders of the day and piano makers. And this all makes sense. But, you know, getting into the modern day, we have an example here. The last one is Yamaha. And Yamaha made a, well, you know, they make motorcycles.
Right.
They've done that for a long, long time.
Sure.
But they make keyboards and pianos and, you know, all kinds of other stuff. But this isn't their first foray into the automotive world. They made a complete concept car, which we'll tell you about in just a minute.
But they did start as a piano and organ manufacturer in 1887.
In 1887, yeah. So they've been around a long, long time. Now, in, I think it was mid-90s, around 96, 97, I think, they made the Ford show engine, you know, for the Ford Taurus, the show engine, 3.4 liter dual rear cam V8. They jointly designed it, you know, between Ford and Yamaha. And I think they also made another four cylinder engine for Ford. I think it was the Ford Puma. They used that one. I don't remember. We didn't get the Puma here, but, yeah, so that's another one. They also, you know what? They also build, the Volvo 4.4 liter V8 that's found in the XC90 and S80 models. They also work with British sports car maker Noble. Well, actually, in a way, I guess they use the same Volvo V8, but it's a twin turbo version of that for their M600 model. And then Yamaha also tunes engines for Toyota, which I didn't know. So you can have a Toyota engine that's tuned by Yamaha. Yeah.
Can we take just a second to name some of the crazy things that Yamaha makes? I'm not saying, when I say crazy, I'm not saying they're bad inherently at all. What I'm saying is this is one of those companies that is like General Electric. You know, it's like Samsung. You will be so surprised when you dig in and learn how much stuff this institution makes. Short list for you. Okay. Keyboards, you know, like pianos, organs. No big whoop. We knew that.
Sure.
Motorcycles. Also knew that.
Yep.
Band instruments. So trumpets, things of that nature.
Makes sense.
Knew that. Harmonicas as well.
Perfect sense.
Guitars. Small engines. Watercraft. Sporting goods. They started, music schools. They build robots, semiconductors, and furniture.
Oh, and I think they made golf carts. Furniture. They made furniture?
They made furniture.
There's Yamaha furniture? I had no idea. And now they've made this, this car. This is, not brand new. I think this is in 2015, maybe the end of 2015. They made something called the Yamaha Sports Ride concept. And I believe the idea behind this one is that, it's sort of like a semi-boutique car. It's the possibility of making like a low number of production vehicles, like maybe let's say like a run of 1,000, a planned run of 1,000. But make it affordable. Make it so that they can actually do this. And they project that by using this, it's kind of like a modular idea in that it's all scalable as well. So, this construction system will allow them to, you know, run off 1,000 copies and save time in the process and save money in the process and be able to do something like that without losing their shirt. And they could do that, you know, one little group here, one little group there, and they can change the design a little bit and make it something different. It's a fascinating idea. And if they can get it to work, it'd be really cool. And I tell you, if you look at this vehicle, it's called the Yamaha Sports Ride concept. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a functioning concept at all or if it's just an idea at this point. The one that they showed at this, at the show, it looks pretty remarkable. It's a really cool looking sports car, very futuristic. And if the idea, again, I think the guy that was involved with the McLaren project, the McLaren F1, I think he was involved in this as well. I've got his name here somewhere. I'll find it in just a second.
That makes sense.
Oh, Gordon Murray. Gordon Murray, who is the guy that did all the carbon fiber work on the McLaren F1, he's involved in this project. So he's the one who's trying to make this modular idea work.
Huh.
So it has legs. There's something to this. And I hope that Yamaha does end up with something out of this, you know, that that they can create this vehicle that they call the iframe vehicle. You know, so it all comes down to the way they manufacture it, that it makes it affordable, that they can do something like that. So, again, I know that some of those we went a little bit too deep into, and maybe
I know. This is interesting history.
I get confused with when there's so many players in these things. And the timing of when the companies buy companies.
And the names change.
Well, if we're not focused on just one, like we were just telling the Heine Velox story.
Right, or just telling the story of Honda or something.
Yeah, or the Steinway Mercedes, the American Mercedes. It would be a little bit more in-depth and probably a little bit more polished, I guess. So my apologies for that, but just to understand that there is this crazy connection between piano makers and automobile companies, and there has been for, 125 years now at this point.
And it's real, and it's not a conspiracy theory.
No.
I disagree with you saying that we went in a little too much detail with some of these. I don't respectfully disagree. I disrespectfully disagree because I feel that the only way to conclude this podcast is to have a duel with tuning hammers.
And scars will be had out of that, I'm sure, because we're going to really go at it. I mean, like, they must have really, really been fighting. If you're fighting with hammers with your boss, you know?
It's a hammer fight.
That's a bad
thing.
Well,
maybe what happened is that one of them just threw one. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Although, as much as I know that's probably the case, I love this picture of these two guys, you know, tuning hammer in each hand.
Yeah.
And ready to go at it Fight Club style.
I do like that. It's like the old, remember the old, like the bare knuckle fighters from that day?
Yeah.
Like how they stood and they had the waistband that was way, way high on their body and they're like, they got their hands up like that. Like, you know, gonna duke it out.
Well, since Scott and I are obviously going to go start our own piano-themed fight club, we're going to get out of here. We hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. Let us know if you are aware of any strange connections between other seemingly dissimilar entities or institutions. You know, like we've talked about appliance makers.
How about Peugeot making pepper mills?
Yeah,
oh,
right.
I went to a restaurant I was at a steakhouse a month and a half ago, maybe.
Two months ago. Oh, okay.
Listen, it's a local place. It's not anything fancy.
I appreciate you taking your top hat off.
I got to tell you, it's sort of fancy, but not really fancy, okay?
Uh-huh.
So I'm there, and my wife stepped away from the table for a moment, and I'm sitting at the table alone. There's a pepper mill there, and it was right after we had recorded the Peugeot story.
Uh-huh.
So I pick up the pepper mill, and I look underneath, and it says Peugeot on it.
It
truly was there, and I looked around, and they're on every table.
Whoa.
That's kind of cool, isn't it?
So
I mean,
did you take one?
No, I didn't, but I mean, it was kind of, and then when she came back, of course, I was super proud to show her that I knew that this is a Peugeot pepper mill, which she didn't care. She really didn't care. She could care less. Didn't even know that Peugeot was a car, I don't think.
No way.
I don't think she did. No, I had to fill in that part
like
of the story.
Why this is important.
Well, you know, they're just not here in the States. It's not a common brand.
So that she didn't think you were just an underground pepper mill enthusiast.
But how do you like that, though? I mean, we had just talked about it, and it was probably a couple weeks after. I don't know when the time frame was. I've lost track of time now, but I picked up the pepper mill, and there it was.
That's crazy,
man. It is, yeah. I wonder how many others are out there that I've been neglecting over the years.
Yeah, and I wonder, what if you just asked them if you could have one?
I don't think they would.
You have a little too much dignity for that.
They're not going to give away their pepper.
I'll go.
But you know what? I love hearing about like companies that have done some unusual things. I think there was one mentioned here. There's a car company that built bird cages to start with. I don't remember who that was.
Honda started out as a bicycle manufacturer, which actually makes more sense. But it's strange because if you look back at the history of so many established car companies, some of which are no longer around now, what you often find is that they started out making something else. And then the automotive age swept in and fundamentally changed the world as we know it.
Yeah, look at the International story that we just did. The International Harvester.
Oh, yeah.
It was literally a harvester.
Great example.
And then they started making trucks, and they did a fantastic job of building trucks for a long, long time. It's just a weird spinoff thing that happens.
Yeah, and if you would like to hear more stories like that, check out some of our history episodes on our website, carstuffshow.com, which has, as we like to say, every single audio podcast we've ever done, and oh, friends and neighbors, That's a lot.
Yeah, we're like 730, somewhere around there, something like that.
Are we?
I think we're around, yeah, we're above 700, but not quite at 750.
I wonder what we should do for number 1,000.
1,000, that's a long way off if we're doing one a week.
Yeah, that's true. So we've got time to plan. You can
long
well,
time.
As always, our best ideas come from you. So let us know what you think on Facebook and Twitter. We are CarStuffHSW. When you go there, you'll see that our friend Gabriel Salazar just sent in a really cool picture of a Hudson that I suggest you check out on our Twitter. And Scott's updating all kinds of interesting, sometimes deep cuts, obscure stuff on our Facebook page. And if you're a car fan, or even if you're just a history fan, you will enjoy a lot of the stuff that we have there. And most importantly of all, we would like to hear your ideas. What should we cover in an upcoming topic? Why do you think so many weird industries get sucked into the dangerous game of auto manufacturing? Let us know. You can write to us directly. We are
CarStuff at HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.